British Public Radio. Current Affairs.
Worldview presents a Chatham House event. The crisis in Syria. Is there a way out? In the chair, ITV News International Editor Bill Neely.
It's been a busy 36 hours in Syria. We've seen the formation of a new opposition coalition with a new clerical leader. 155 people have been reported killed in the last 24 hours. Israel has carried out its second consecutive strike on Syria, the first direct military strike on Syria since 1973. The Turkish president has warned of the risk of Syria using chemical weapons, and in response, the NATO Secretary General has said NATO will do whatever it takes to protect Turkey. With me to discuss Syria, I have two panellists. To my direct right, I've got David Butter, who's an associate fellow at Chatham House. And to his right, we've got Martin Chulov, who lives in Beirut at the moment and is the Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. Martin.
I've been in the region for the last 7 years. Three of those years were in Jerusalem. The three were between Baghdad and Beirut. And the last 18 months to 2 years has been exclusively covering the phenomenon we now know as the Arab Spring. Over the last 12 months, I've been to Syria 7 times. I have not been able to secure a regime visa, which means that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to go to parts of the country that are controlled by the regime. So as a result of that, I've spent most of my time, if not all of my time, on the opposition side, reporting from Aleppo, from Idlib, from Jabal al-Zawiya, from Homs, and from other parts of the countryside around Hama. So I have seen a lot of the country. I have seen a lot of what this revolution does represent, or this revolution that has become civil war. In the past year, I've seen a lot of changes too. I've seen what started out as unambiguously a popular uprising in the southern town of Deraa, inspired by the events in Tunis, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Bahrain. These people in southern Syria were looking for precisely the same sorts of things as their counterparts elsewhere in the region: self-determination, a sense of dignity, being able to shape your own destiny, to step out from underneath the boot of dictatorship. A very pervasive police state had been governing their lives for so long, and they wanted the rights to say, well, we want to shape our own lives. It started like that, and it largely remains like that in terms of values. However, what we have seen is this original uprising evolve first into armed insurrection, then into a full-blown civil war, and now it is taking on a more global or a more regional element. And so we are at a very decisive phase in what is going on in Syria at the moment. And I do want to talk about that. What we've seen in the last couple of months, in particular since the armed opposition stormed into Damascus and Aleppo, the two biggest cities in the country, the two most decisive cities in terms of the overall battle for Syria's destiny. Since the beginning of Ramadan, we have seen a push by, I guess you could call them, global jihadi types who have entered, especially around Aleppo, and they are entering in reasonably large numbers now. It's been particularly evident in my last two trips. My last trip was, I returned from Syria, I think just over a week ago. During that period, for the first time in covering this revolution, I can say that the almost every substantial armed operation inside Aleppo is being conducted with at least some members of al-Qaeda aligned groups. This is a very different dynamic to what was taking place earlier in the revolution and to what is taking place or continues to take place elsewhere in the country. It is obvious that the two global jihadi groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, they're Syrians, but many of them have spent time in Iraq, involved in the insurgency there. They brought back insurgent skills with them, and they are deploying them reasonably effectively. And there are also another group of foreign Arabs who come from right around the region, right around the Sunni Islamic world, called al-Mujahideen. They are crossing from Turkey. They are setting up training camps in the Aleppo hinterland, and they are increasingly joining the front lines of an insurgency which has until recently been very nationalistic in terms of its goals. One element that I did learn in my last trip, actually, which I wasn't aware of prior to that, is I sat down with a number of these guys, the foreign Arabs from Iraq, from Tunis, from Libya, from Sudan, from Saudi Arabia, and they said that one of the reasons that they are there now is they believe that what is taking place in Syria is the fulfillment of an Islamic prophecy, and that is that a decisive battle will be fought in and around Aleppo with the Christians on their side, ahead of a final battle with the Persians, which is what they believe will be Armageddon. This was an element that I wasn't prepared for, I hadn't heard of, and I've since spent a lot of time studying this hadith that they are referring to, and it certainly underpins a lot of the reasons for why these guys are coming. Now, what does it mean? How does it change things? Well, it very definitely plays to this Syrian regime narrative, and that is that it's been a foreign terrorist plot from the beginning, and it was always about a subversion backed by Western states. Now, I don't believe that is the case. In fact, there's very little to support that, but the fact that this sort of the insurgency is changing shape such as this no doubt supports the Assad narrative and gives the regime some sort of comfort. What does it mean in terms of an international reaction? Well, it's very clear that that Europe, Britain, America are and have been for many months now terrified of this revolution changing into a full-blown regional insurgency that they can't contain. Syria is created along some substantial regional geopolitical fault lines. Sunni Shia, Arab Persian, there's even the old Soviet America feud that still runs through Tartus and through Damascus. So there are any number of ways that this conflict could spiral out of control. The political decision in Doha in the last week or so has been very interesting, not for so much what it represents, and that is a more inclusive body, an umbrella sort of body that effectively acts as a government in exile, and that the Arab League and the Americans and the British are prepared to actually represent. It supplants the Syrian National Council, which has, as we know, did not perform, did not meet expectations, and lost the confidence of any potential donors or backers. So what we do have now is a group that, rightly or wrongly, Western states, especially Britain, who are front-footing this, are prepared to throw their weight behind. The British moves since the US election have been quite stunning in the sense that David Cameron, within an hour of Obama claiming victory, was on Jordanian soil, not far from the Syrian border, saying that they will talk to the armed opposition. Following that, we had John Wilkes saying that, who is the Syrian envoy, the FCO envoy, saying that, you know, he would lead the talks himself, and that they could talk about weapons. We now have Britain firmly supporting this new Syrian body and convening a donor conference in London on Friday to look to raise funds, and they are not being too specific or too worried about how these funds are spent. In other words, the taboo word of weaponry, which has been a taboo for so long, is not anymore. Well, unless I'm misreading that, but I don't think I am. I've had discussions in recent days, and certainly diplomats aren't warning us off, saying, you know, don't talk about weapons. So there does seem to be a very significant shift in thinking post the US poll and post this decision in Doha. So we are at a decisive phase in terms of what the international community does. Are they prepared to move towards any sort of a direct intervention or not? And if they were, how could they get past the roadblock at the UN, which is certainly at the Security Council, which has stopped things so far? I guess just to conclude, this revolution in Syria was a bottom-up revolution. Revolutions are always messy. It was not a coup. It was not a top-down thing. It was basically an attempt to lift the lid off a pressure cooker of totalitarian control for so long. And, you know, as a result, we've seen all of these disparate, fragmented groups start to rise. And they've worked against each other. The military council doesn't support the rebel units. The political council doesn't talk to any sort of, you know, alternative civil society or military group at all. It's been disastrous in terms of forming any sort of a cohesive, credible alternative to the Assad regime, which, rightly, whether you like it or not, is a strong sort of governing authority in that country. This attempt that we are seeing at the moment to unite these disparate rebel groups, the civil side, the military side, I think this is pretty much do or die in terms of how this revolution proceeds from here. If we can't get any cohesive, coordinated chain of command, if we can't get any sort of inclusive dealings between the exiled political leaders and the military leaders inside the country who are doing the fighting, then I don't see a way forward. So I think that we're 20 months into this revolution, and the next 2 to 3 months, I think, will be extremely decisive, and I think some very careful decisions have to be made, especially by those who may or may not be considering intervention at this point. I mean, the risks of missteps in this part of Arabia in particular are enormous. Syria could very easily spill over into Lebanon, into Turkey, into Jordan, into Israel, into Iraq. There is a risk, if things don't go well, of some kind of balkanization of the Levant along ethnic sectarian lines, and that's a nightmare scenario, as we all know. So I hope it doesn't get to that point. I think, as I say, some very careful decisions need to be made at this point, and I will certainly be watching with interest from my vantage point.
Martin, thank you very much. I'd like to pick up on a few of those points later. Just to throw in one thing, the head of Britain's armed forces, General Sir David Richards, said this week that Britain's military could intervene in the next few months under very limited circumstances, a very limited response, he said. But he is talking about it. Martin, thank you. David.
Thank you. I'm David Butter. I'm an associate fellow here at Chatham House in the Middle East and North Africa programme. I first became familiar with Syria in the late 70s when I was working as a reporter in Beirut. And I think a lot of the lessons I learnt then from one of Martin's distinguished predecessors, David Hurst, used to always talk about the moral and political bankruptcy of the Arab regimes. And the sheer brutality of that regime at that period, both in Lebanon and inside Syria, of course, during the first Muslim Brother insurgency then, was very clear to me at that time. Since then, I've worked mainly on economy and business matters, while obviously keeping a weather eye on the politics with Middle East Economic Digest and recently with the Economist Intelligence Unit. And in the course of that, of course, in Syria, I've become familiar with a lot of the people who are playing a very important role now and potentially in the future. I recall great fondness Riyad Saif, for example, in a business context of being, a fantastic person to have around in Damascus, to give a perspective from a very small and embattled private sector and political dissident. I mean, in light of what we've heard from Martin and Bill, it might seem a bit perverse that I've chosen to focus on, to sort of draw back a little bit and focus mainly on economic issues and social issues. But I think they are of crucial importance, and they will be of absolute, even more crucial importance as and when this crisis ends, because the scale of the devastation of Syrian society and economy is such that it's going to be a massive challenge to try and rebuild the country. Going into the whole economic factors, I mean, here at Chatham House, we have a sort of debate forming about how important the economy was to the Arab Spring. My view is that it's a very important part of the picture, but not a driver. And certainly in places like Syria, its brutality, repression, the ability of people to express themselves politically and to obtain freedom, really, which were the main drivers. The economy was there, of course. The long period of stifling, inefficient state domination of the economy, and then more recently, liberalisation. And there is a debate here about whether we throw the baby of some of the good things that liberalisation did deliver in places like Egypt and Syria in terms of private sector investment and jobs, and the bathwater of corrupt, really corrupt, brutal crony capitalism, which probably reached its biggest, most blatant exemplar in Syria with the behaviour of some of the oligarchs around the Assad regime. One of the misfortunes, I think, of Syria in this, when we look at the outside world and how little the outside world has been able to achieve in helping the Syrian people, is that although Syria is important politically in the region as a spoiler, as an ally with Iran, as potentially a military counterpart to Israel, as an economic prize, Syria is not that important. It's got a limited population size and consequently market, only about 21, 22 million people. The GDP per head didn't really get up above anything more than about $2,800 before the crisis. It's got a little bit of oil, but not much. There was potential there. There was enough potential there for small-scale interest in Syria as a place to do business. Turkish companies, for example, saw it's a lot of potential there to outsource a lot of their industry. Syrian firms sprung up, which were very successful in accessing the Turkish market. You started to have some Gulf money coming in and Syrian diaspora money coming in. And that potentially is still there. And I think that when you're looking to the future, the Syrian diaspora, and I guess some of the people around here would fall into that category, and particularly those in the UK, have potentially a very important role in supporting the rebuilding of Syria. And I know that a lot of the business people who were kind of on the regime's side to some extent before are now prepared, have made clear they're prepared to play a constructive role in the future. So what's been the damage to the Syrian economy from this crisis? Well, at the Economist Intelligence Unit, where I recently was, they're looking this year at a contraction of GDP of 10%. I'd say it's more. I'd say we're looking at more like 20-25% contraction of GDP. That would bring the per capita income of Syrians down probably below $2,000. The oil sanctions that were imposed by the EU didn't really start to bite until the end of last year. But this year, effectively, the main source of government foreign exchange revenue has disappeared. Of course, another source was tourism, and that's also disappeared. There's inadequate production of oil going on in the country to meet demand for products. And I think this winter, with the Syrian population reliant very heavily on imported diesel for fuel to keep warm, conditions could really get catastrophic. We've already got 200,000, 300,000, who knows how many refugees outside the country and internally displaced well over 2 million destruction in many of the houses. We've got symptoms of distress in the in availability of foreign exchange. Now, the central bank is still protesting that it has $15 billion of foreign exchange in reserves. But that, of course, doesn't tally with the figures it has actually published itself of the current account deficit last year, which was about $9 billion, which would have, without any capital inflows, would have brought foreign exchange reserves into single figures. So I think they're getting very tight. The black market exchange rate lurched down below 100 at the beginning of this year, then stabilized at 70 when the central bank put some cash into the market. But really, in the last few weeks, it started to slide again, and we're hearing that it's now about 80 after being 70 for much of the period between March and October. Inflation is now really starting to ravage the country, and we're seeing some regional variations. This is probably the only official statistic that is regularly updated in Syria, and of course there are caveats as to how reliable that may be. But based, you know, on the government's own calculation, you have a year-on-year inflation of 40% now, and that's now 50% in Aleppo. The fuel component of that index in Aleppo is now 120% inflation. So you can see that people are paying, bread and flour, 70%. And these things are going to get worse. We're going to see hyperinflation and probably a much more difficult situation on the foreign exchange front. The government, of course, maintains a kind of business-as-usual fantasy in that it does persist with starting a new school year. It has even announced a budget for 2013, which is really kind of absurd, but it's part of the, I think, political and propaganda message that the government's attempting to put out. But at the same time, it does indicate a level of resilience in the regime structures, the bureaucracy that continues to really have no option but to go along with the regime for want of any other real alternatives. And that also raises a question of when the regime is dismantled. I think it's in the programme which has come out from the National Coalition, item 2-3, as I recall, is the dismantlement of the entire structure of the current state. Well, you know, clearly in practice, there's going to be a difficult negotiation to be held about which parts of the regime have to be retained and to continue working if there's any viable way of rebuilding it. I think there is a risk of financial implosion, which I think would go along with any advances on the ground from the opposition. The turnaround politically with the opposition really over the last 48 hours, I think, is clearly something that would be reflected in increased momentum on the ground in terms of the Free Syrian Army and the military opposition. And this is going to increase pressure on the regime. It could run out of cash to pay state employees, to pay troops, to buy the fuel that it needs to move its troops around the country. How much is it receiving in help from Iran, Russia, some extent Iraq, Venezuela even? Well, clearly some help and some very important help. But at some point, if we look at Russia, for example, does it make any sense to continue betting on this particular dead horse? And isn't it perhaps possible that Russia could consider refining its own position? When we get to the stage of regime collapse, or if we do, the idea that, or the structures that you'd need to support the Syrian people with humanitarian aid and with any kind of economic rebuilding really aren't there. I mean, I think that's not surprising given that the political structures of the opposition have been so ramshackle. But I do think that these issues need to be looked at quite closely, and it's something that in time the opposition, the new coalition, really ought to be starting to focus on.